Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Good morning. Thanks for joining me on The Garden Show. It just does not get much more beautiful than the weather we are having. Last few days have been just those kind of days we dream of. Now the weekend's here, and lo and behold, you know how it always is, beautiful weekdays. You're stuck in the office. It's gorgeous outside. Finally, the weekend comes around, and it starts to rain, or it gets ugly for some reason, and it's never fair when that happens. But this weekend, gorgeous, beautiful, beautiful weather, the kind of weather that makes you want to get out there in the garden and just lose yourself for the whole day, just to enjoy the beauty that you're creating, whether you're putting in flower beds and enjoying the gorgeous colors and fragrances of the flowers you're planting, or whether you're putting in vegetable gardens and getting those seeds and transplants of vegetables that you know are going to be producing wonderful food for you later on. It's just a great feeling when we have beautiful weather like this. It's like it's air-conditioned outside. The temperatures stay nice. The sun is delightful. And we really can enjoy this. And we don't get a whole lot of this kind of weather, so we do treasure it when it comes around. And we'll be thinking fondly back on this as we move into the hotter weather in May. Start hitting the 80s. We begin to start getting a little on the warm side. But for today, take advantage of this. Now, if you've been putting off doing some planting, I've mentioned this is a very active time of the year for planting flowers. You also are planting a large number of vegetables. In particular, we're moving into our spring, early summer vegetables, very popular vegetables like tomatoes and peppers and eggplants and squash and cucumbers and snap beans. These are all being planted right now, and indeed you need to get many of those planted by the early part of April. Vegetable gardening is in high gear right now. You really should be, if you're a vegetable gardener or intended on doing some this year, you need to be kicking into high gear this weekend, getting your beds all prepared, coming to some decisions on what vegetables you want to grow and how much, and then heading on out to the nurseries and getting you some wonderful vegetables. There are two ways we grow them, and I should mention almost all gardeners these days, pretty younger gardeners, just almost automatically focus on transplants. You know, they're quick, they're easy, instant gratification. You have the plants right there, and there are lots of advantages of using transplants. Don't get me wrong, they are indispensable in home vegetable gardening for a whole lot of vegetables, tomatoes, peppers, and eggplants. We really rely on nurseries to provide transplants of those to us for planting this time of the year. But there are some vegetables that are so darn easy to grow from seed that if you'd like to do that, there's no reason why you shouldn't give it a try. And tinkering a little bit with the seeds builds up your confidence and allows you to see a crop as it is born and completely develops right before your eyes. And a couple of crops that are particularly easy to seed include the cucurbits. And the cucumber family includes lots of popular vegetables, notably cucumbers, of course, but squash, summer squash, winter squash, cantaloupes, watermelons, guguzza, all of these are members of the cucumber family. And they have nice large seeds. You plant them about a half inch to an inch underground and keep them watered, and they're up and going like gangbusters. The young seedlings have a robust growth habit, unlike some other vegetables. Tomatoes have a relatively slow rate of growth as a seedling. They have to be kind of coddled along. But, you know, you put some cucumber seeds down, when they pop out of the ground, they're ready to go. The other group are the legumes. And this time of the year, snap beans are a really big legume crop we're planting. Legumes are the beans and the southern peas. And, of course, again, the seeds are large, easy to handle, easy to plant. And the seedlings that pop up out of ground grow vigorously. So don't forget, there are some vegetables that are pretty easy to direct seed right into the garden where you intend to grow them. But the only difference is, don't forget, the seeds need moisture. So although we water transplants in thoroughly and then pay attention to watering them again as needed till they get on their feet, for seeds, they're close to the surface. It dries out fairly quickly. We may want to water a seed bed every day just to make sure the surface of the soil stays nice and damp to encourage the seeds to come up. Other difference is, once we plant transplants, we immediately mulch all around them with the mulch pulled up to the base of the transplants, about an inch thick to 2 inches, depending on how big your transplants are. But when planting seeds, we can't mulch over the seeded area. So leave the area, either the strips where the seeds were planted or the top of the row where the seeds were planted, leave that bare. And then when the seeds come up, when the seedlings are big enough, then go ahead and get that mulch around them as soon as possible to help with weeds. So a bit of a vegetable gardening information there to encourage you to get on out and get those gardens planted. It's a perfect time of the year as well. As the flowers that you can plant. One of the most popular vegetables, I guess I should mention, tomatoes. A question I get a lot this time of the year is, you know, what kind of tomato cultivars or varieties does the LSU Ag Center recommend for the home gardener to plant? And we do have our recommended cultivars for you. Easy to access the information. We have a fabulous online tomato growing publication. If you're new to growing tomatoes, you definitely need to look at it. If you've been growing tomatoes, you'll still get benefit from it. If you've had problems growing your tomatoes and you're wondering what's going on and need some help with that, this publication is really excellent. Easy to get to. All you need to do is, in your favorite search engine, type LSU Ag Center Home Tomatoes. LSU Ag Center Home Tomatoes. That'll pull up links to our tomato publication. You just click on that and you'll find, again, all of the recommended tomato cultivars, and you can choose from those when you go to your local nurseries and garden centers to make sure you're getting good cultivars that have proven their worth and performance here in our area. All righty, folks, time for a break, but we got plenty of time for y'all to call on in. I'm here to answer your gardening questions this morning. That number to call is 504-260-1870. Stay tuned. We'll be back right after these messages. Good morning. Thanks for joining me on The Garden Show. We're talking gardening, and if you've got a problem or a question I can help you out with, I'd love to hear from you. 504-260-1870 is the number you can call. If you need some gardening information, 504-260-1870, and I'll be happy to help you. We have Gary in New Orleans.
Yeah, hello.
Gary, good morning.
Hey, how you doing, Dan?
Gary, I'm great. What can I do for you?
Okay, I have a rubber plant that I thought died last year. He told me to cut it down to the dirt. And if I see any green, it'll grow back where it did grow back. But the only problem I'm having with it now is that, like, one of the leaves on it is, like, somebody might have tore it or it might have split from the wind. Should I cut that off, or should I tape that or something so it connect back together, or what?
Well, you know, Gary, It's up to you, basically. It's not probably a humongous deal to the plant. But here's the deal. Plants can't heal their tissues the way we can. If we get cut, we can get stitches or just put a tape to hold the cut together, and our flesh will actually re-knit and heal together. If we break a bone, we can set that bone, hold it in place, and the bone will literally regrow and re-knit together, healing over the break. That doesn't happen with plants. If you break a plant's branch, you could splint it back up, put it right where it was, just like you might splint an arm, but the broken area will never re-knit. It will never heal back again. So plants just don't have that ability. If you damage a leaf, that leaf will sustain that damage for its life. So any tear in a leaf is always going to be in that leaf. There's no way for you to correct it, no way for you to heal it. If you tape it, it will maybe look better, although odd, but that split will never really knit back together. You could never take the tape off and have the leaf a whole again. So what I would say is, if the damage really bothers you, I mean, it really irritates you, it makes the plant look bad, it bothers you every time you look at it, you might want to go ahead and just trim the leaf off. If you look at it and say, I wish it wasn't split, but it's not that bad, and the leaf still looks pretty good, mm-hmm. it's still working for the plant, I can live with it, well, then leave the leaf on there, Gary. But again, there's really nothing you can do to change the damage other than decide to keep it or remove it.
Okay, so when is the best time to fertilize that?
Well, during the growing season, which is any time it's sending out new growth, or generally during the summertime, and the easiest way to, and this is in a container?
Yes, sir.
The easiest way...
It's a big flower pot.
Yeah, the easiest way to fertilize a plant in a big flower pot is with a slow-release fertilizer, Gary. Something like, there's a product called Osmocote. And Osmocote is a fertilizer that you just sprinkle on the soil surface of the pot, and it slowly releases nutrients over time. Every time you water, it releases some mineral nutrients. And that way, you just put that on there once, and it fertilizes the plant for the entire season. You don't have to worry about, oh, did I forget to fertilize this week, or do I need to fertilize? So I would recommend a slow release for that plant because it's effective, and it's easy and labor-saving.
Okay, one last question. I have an ivy plant that's inside. It has black spots on it. I suppose that it's mold, maybe. How do I treat that?
Hard to say, Gary. Fungal diseases do occasionally hit indoor plants and can cause leaf spotting to occur. But it's hard to say that, you know, it warrants the use of going and buying, you know, a $15 bottle of fungicide and bringing it home and trying to spray. You can't get rid of the spots it's got, even if you start spraying it. For most of us, what I'd recommend you do is any of the leaves that look particularly bad, the ones with the worst spots, remove those and just throw those away. And then make sure you don't wet the leaves when you water. Avoid wetting the foliage. Keeping the foliage dry is a way of minimizing leaf spots and things like that from showing up. So I don't think I'd resort to a fungicide for one indoor plant. I would just do the leaf removal and keep the foliage dry.
Yeah, so there's like little black spots on all of them, and I don't know if that's mold or what.
But I was going to say, sometimes seeing is going to make a big difference in what you've got. What I'd recommend you do is send some pictures to the following email address, gnogardening.
I'm sorry, say that again?
It's gnogardening.
Gnogardening.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
You got the okay. At?
Yeah, uh-huh.
Ag Center, AgCenter.
Okay.
.lsu.
Okay.
.edu.
Okay.
Now,
all right.
That is the general email address for the Greater New Orleans area, all the parishes on the South Shore. So if you've got a gardening question, you want to send in some photographs or anything like that, that email address is a great one to have on hand. And Gary, you can also take some leaves to your local nursery or garden center. Sometimes they'll have somebody on staff that is familiar and can help you out with that. But otherwise, that's gnogardening@agcenter.lsu.edu. You send it in there, and they'll give you a hand.
Okay, so other than that, I can take a picture of them and bring it to the garden later.
Absolutely. That'll work, too.
Thank you. Sound like a winner.
Gary, thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
Appreciate you.
All righty. Bye-bye now. All righty. Let's see here. We got Kathy calling in, and she's up next, calling from Slidell. Hey, Kathy, good morning.
Hello. How are you doing?
I'm great. What
I
you
have
got?
Some serious, I don't know if I'm saying it right, the night-blooming cactus. And I wanted to find out what's the best fertilizer for that, because when I bought them, the lady said there's a particular number that helps them bloom better.
Well, the mineral nutrient most associated with proper flowering is phosphorus, and phosphorus is the middle number in the three-number analysis you see on fertilizer labels. So a fertilizer that was 888 would be 8% nitrogen, 8% phosphate, and that's the one we're looking at, and 8% potash, which is the potassium level. So what she might have been recommending to you is just saying they need to have an adequate supply of phosphorus to bloom properly, but that doesn't mean you need to buy a fertilizer that has a high middle number and emphasizes the phosphorus. And the reason for that is plants don't absorb those three minerals equally. They absorb three times as much nitrogen as they do phosphorus, and they absorb twice as much potassium as they do phosphorus. So even though phosphorus is important for flowering, using a fertilizer that has a real high middle number is silly, because plants don't absorb as much phosphorus as they do the other two mineral nutrients. So avoid fertilizers that say bloom stimulators or granny's bloomers or anything that you look at that has a high middle number. Applying too much phosphorus is a common mistake. Look for a fertilizer that has a balanced analysis, and that means about the same number all the way across, like 20-20-20 or 13-13-13. You can also use a fertilizer that sort of matches the way the plants absorb their mineral nutrients, a high first number, a low middle number, and a third number in between, like 15-5-10. I would recommend you use a soluble fertilizer and apply it once a month, around about April, May, June, July, and August, and that should do the trick. Got to go to a news break. Appreciate your call, folks. We got the CBS News Break coming up, and then right after that, Don Ames is going to catch you up on the WWL First News. All righty. Sorry about that, people. Thanks for joining me. We're talking gardening here as the second half hour of the first hour of the Garden Show comes on in. We've got good questions, and if you got to call in with one of yours, feel free to go ahead and give us a call. That phone number is 504-260-1870. That's 504-260-1870. If you've got a gardening transplant, a gardening question, I was looking down at some of my notes about what I've already talked about this morning, and we were talking about seeding versus transplanting earlier. So feel free to go ahead and give me a call, and I'll be glad to help you out. Alrighty, we've got Tina calling in from Ponchatoulis. Hey, Tina, good morning.
Good morning. I have two questions for you. My first question is, I seem to have a lot of trouble with ants. I get an ant pile, and I treat it, and it goes away and then pops up somewhere else. And I wanted to find out, what is the best product to use for that to kill the ants?
Well, Tina, understand that you're never going to be rid of them.
Okay.
Did you think you could eradicate them from your yard and they just wouldn't be there anymore?
I was hoping there was something that could be done.
There's nothing like bad news. They're always moving in, Tina, always. If you could snap your fingers right now and eradicate every anthill, these are usually fire ants, in your yard. Within a few months, you'd have hills again from fire ants moving into that nice open area where there aren't any fire ants. So controlling fire ants is an ongoing effort. There's nothing we can do to eradicate them permanently. Now, what you may find, there are two methods we have of treating for them, and that is a mound treatments or treating an entire area. And generally speaking, we find treating the entire area with a bait, AMDRO is a popular bait, Logic is another bait, that you scatter them evenly over the area, you get a longer-term control than by just treating each hill. The reason for that is that when you put bait over the entire yard, the ants pick it up. The little hills that you don't see yet, they pick it up. The big hills that you can see, they pick it up, take it back to the queen, and kill off the nest. So it kills the tiny colonies that you can't see yet. If you just treat the nests that you can see, then before you know it, the little nests that you couldn't see will have gotten bigger because you've taken away all their competition by killing off the big established nests. So try, if you've done the mound treatments, you know what that's like, and you go, well, you know, now that Dan has explained, I'll never be rid of them, I can go around every now and again and treat these hills as they show up, and I'm okay with that. If you want to do something different and say, I really want longer control, something that's going to be more effective, then use the baits, spread them over your entire property, and if you can get your neighbors to treat their yards as well, you will all benefit from that.
Great. Now, my next question is this. I just want to do a little small flower bed around my mailbox. The problem is I have neighborhood dogs that get loose, and they come over, and it's a known fact. I've seen it. They go attracted to my mailbox for some reason. Is there some kind of pansy or marigold or something that I can put that's colorful and attractive but yet would detour neighborhood pets from coming to that area?
I don't know of any plants that would, you know, necessarily repel a dog or anything. You could get an animal repellent and spray it on the pole of your mailbox regularly, so that as they come up and smell the pole, they get a dose of a repellent that they find objectionable, and it might encourage them to move on.
Okay. All right. And I could get that like at your local Home Depot or Lowe's?
Yeah. Nursery, garden center, hardware store is going to have animal repellents. Then plant the bed with various cactuses.
That's a good
some good agaves with those sharp blades and vicious teeth along the sides. And before you know it, the animals will be no trouble at all.
Okay. Well, thank you for your help.
All righty, Tina. Good luck with it.
Thank you.
All right, folks. Bye-bye now. Folks, we got to take a little break. Don't go away. If you're waiting with a question, you hang in there because you know your question's important to me. And if you'd like to call in with a new one, 504-260-1870 is the number to call. We'll be back. Stay tuned. Good morning. We're talking gardening, and you heard the gentleman. Call on in if you've got a gardening question. Up right now is Ann calling in from Gentilly. Good morning, Ann.
Good morning, Dan. I have a question. I thought of two more since then, but anyway. You read the paper, I guess, about Roundup and the potential cancer-causing property that it has. Was this more, do you know, for commercial users of Roundup as opposed to the home user?
Always the amount of exposure is a real factor in dealing with these. The gentleman that filed suit was a maintenance individual that did grounds maintenance and so had contact with the Roundup on a regular basis and doing maintenance on the grounds. Home gardeners, depending on how much they're using it, have very little exposure. You're usually spraying with long wands. You're wearing your plastic gloves. You're not getting it on you. So I think if people, there's still a lot of controversy about that floating around as well. But for people who want to be cautious, some people have decided not to use it at all. Just make sure if you decide to continue to use it that you use it in such a way that you follow the label directions carefully, wear your rubber gloves and other recommended items when doing the spraying. You have to kind of find out where you feel on this situation and go for it that way.
Right. That was sort of my thinking because homeowner wouldn't use it that often. So the question I had also, about 7 or 8 years ago, I purchased a sapling, a cypress tree sapling from Parkway Partners annual sale. The tree is now about 15 feet tall, and I'm wondering, their lower branches, like 3 or 4 feet from the ground, can I snip those off?
And you really should. People don't realize sometimes that wherever a branch originates on the trunk of the tree, it's where that branch is going to be for the life of the tree. In our mind, somehow, we have this vision of branches sort of rising up off the ground and getting higher because we see trees with naked trunks and the branches are all up high. But that simply means that all of the branches that were lower on the trunk have died and fallen off over time, leaving behind the branches up at the top. So by all means, you want to keep a proportion, though, in this, and you don't want to denude the young tree of too much of its foliage. So we keep a proportion of 2/3 green canopy to 1/3 trunk.
Okay.
2/3. So if the tree is, 6 feet tall, it means you can remove all of the branches in the lower 2 feet. Mm-hmm. As the tree grows taller, you can continue to remove the lower branches until you've raised the canopy up to the height you want it to be.
Okay. Thank you. I can do that because I'm thinking maybe I'll just go by my height, which is about 5 feet, and I'll trim everything back. Do I trim flush with the trunk or just leave like a little nub?
A little nub. We call it a lip. So it's almost back to the trunk, but there should be a little lip. The very base of the branch should be left behind for proper healing.
An inch or so thereabouts.
Yes. Well, a half of an inch, perhaps.
Half, okay. And one, the lady called about the animals on her lawn. There was a hint from Heloise that I've been using for many years. Just get a bottle, a spray bottle, fill it with sudsy ammonia, and go out and spray the area. You can spray the lawn. Sometimes if you look at the lawn on an angle, you're standing, you can see like a brighter or darker green circular area, which is obviously where one is going. Mm-hmm. Spray that. And that tends to discourage them. And I've learned over the years, occasionally I just fall behind in that kind of maintenance. And I may have more strays that come. I'll just pour some sudsy ammonia into a hose-end applicator, and I don't worry about dilution or anything. Just pour it, and it, of course, mix it with water. And then just spray the entire lawn area, spray the sidewalk where people walk and the dogs. And that has helped, and I've been doing that probably for a good 10 years now.
Yeah, sudsy ammonia has been. Yeah, it has a long-held reputation as a possible animal repellent. Mothballs, people use a wide variety of things, but ammonia certainly. People use it on their trash cans to keep animals
out
of their trash.
That's where I first read it, Heloise.
Yeah, so it's been out there for a while. I think that might have been Tina, and if she's still listening, that's something you might keep in mind. Oh, Ann, thank you so much for the information.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye
okay.
now.
Bye-bye.
All right, folks, stay tuned. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Talking gardening, and I look forward to answering your question this morning. If you've got something I can help you out with, have a whole nother hour of the Garden Show coming up from 8 to 9. But for right now, we got a few minutes left. Let's go to Judy in Abita Springs. Judy, what can I do for you?
Good morning, Dan.
Hey, Judy, good morning. What you got?
I have a question. I have these beautiful bushes. I think they're called Laura Petulum.
Uh-huh.
They're burgundy leaves, and they make a beautiful little pink, delicate-looking flower.
Yeah, that's it.
And I've let them grow way too tall. And I need to cut them back to about 3 or 4 feet.
Well, they're very forgiving of pruning. So I don't think you're going to have a real issue, Judy. They will tolerate heavy, hard pruning. Most of them are sending out their new growth and blooming right now. I would wait. This is a time of the year when they're particularly lovely. So I'd give them a few more weeks to finish this pretty phase. And then you can cut them back anytime after that. Again, enjoy them until maybe the early middle part of April, and then do your pruning then.
Okay, that sounds great. That's what I wanted to know. I figured I had to wait till it was finished blooming, but then I didn't know if there was one time a year that would be better than the other.
That'll work, Judy. And don't forget, now that you have decided you want them to be shorter, they're not going to stay short just because you cut them back. So remember, you're going to have to go out there at least twice a year and keep those things under control now. All you've done at this point is started an argument. Don't forget, you're going to have to address this as needed. So keep it up, Judy, and you'll have them stay in the size you want. Take care now. Alrighty, folks, we'll be back with more of the Garden Show after we catch y'all up with the news at the top of the hour. Stay tuned. Good morning. Thanks for joining me for my second hour of the Garden Show this morning here on WWL. Nice first hour. Lots of good callers, and I expect to hear from a lot of you out there this hour with your gardening questions that you need some help with. And that number that you need to call to line it up is 504-260-1870. I got an announcement about the Louisiana irises that you need to be aware of going on today, kicking off at 10:30 this morning and running till 11:30 at the New Orleans Botanical Garden, and that's at number 5 Victory Avenue in City Park. Patrick O'Connor, who is a local authority who's nationally known, a major breeder of Louisiana irises, has developed some of the most exquisitely beautiful hybrids of irises, and you have a rare opportunity to get to hear him speak today. He's going to be talking about his efforts to hybridize irises since the late 70s, and he's going to be speaking about the natural history of the five original species of Louisiana irises that have been bred together to create the beautiful modern hybrids that we grow today. He's going to look at current preservation efforts for irises in the wild. He's going to look at the amazing transition that took these native wildflowers of Louisiana and turned them into the beautiful garden flowers they are today. And along the way, you'll get all kinds of tips and advice and information on how to properly grow Louisiana irises to perfection from someone who really, really knows how to grow them here. So again, Patrick O'Connor speaking on Louisiana irises from the wild to the garden. It kicks off this morning at 10:30. Goes till 11:30, and that's at the New Orleans Botanical Garden in City Park. The cost of the lecture is $12. And if you have any questions, the phone number to call is 483-9473. But a really wonderful opportunity there for those of you who have fallen in love with our wonderful native Louisiana irises. Alrighty, let's head to the phones. We've got Lynn on the line, calling in from Cutoff. Lynn, good morning. Thanks for calling in the Garden Show.
Good morning. That's a foggy day over here in South Louisiana. I'm on the road right now. Oh, yeah, I'm on the road right now, and I have a fig tree, an LSU fig tree that's about between four and a half, 5 years old, and it's kind of hugging the ground. It's not more than 3.5, 4 feet tall. Now, it makes a lot of figs, and the figs are good, and it's healthy, but it doesn't seem wants to get any height.
I would leave well enough alone, Lynn. I really would. It will eventually begin to grow more. It's still a relatively young tree at 4 to 5 years. Many fruit trees will take a good 4 or 5 years to settle in before they begin to grow more normally and more vigorously. So at any point now, you may begin to see large shoots popping up out of that fig tree, beginning to establish that tree shape that you're looking for. But at this point, the only disadvantage to the size it is that a smaller size tree produces fewer figs. But the fact that it's low makes the figs easy to harvest. So don't forget there's some advantages to the tree staying low for you without you having to fight it to try to keep it shorter. A lot of people call me and say, you know, I have a fig tree that's 12 feet tall. I can't get the figs at the top anymore. What do I do? So it's okay. But, Lynn, you can't force it to start. If you start cutting on it, you know, cutting off the lower branches, you're removing your fruiting wood. You're lowering your fig production, and that is not worth cutting off those branches. So I leave well enough alone.
What about the ones that are touching the ground? I mean, I have like 4 or 5 that actually, you know how an oak tree just bends down and the branches sometimes touch the ground? Well, I have like 3 or 4 of those that actually touch the ground.
Up to you, Lynn. If they're producing figs, you say to yourself, well, I don't want those figs anyway. Cut them off. But if they're producing figs and you want them, now those branches may actually layer. It's a term called layering. They may actually root into the ground there. And so what you will end up with is sort of a colony of fig trees. And again, there's nothing wrong with that. We grow figs all kinds of ways, as bushes, as trees, in pots. There's no one right way to grow a fig. I think your tree's doing pretty well. Eventually, I promise you, it should start growing taller. Until then, just love it.
Okay, that's exactly what I'm going to do. Thank you very much. Alrighty. Have a blessed day.
You too now. Thanks for the call. All righty, folks. Let's see. We've got Mary calling from Houma. Hey, Mary, good morning. Hello, Mary. Are you still with us? Hey, Mary. Hi there. What can I do for you, Mary?
I have some poinsettias in a pot, and they're about 3 feet tall, but the only leaves they have are where the flowers are at the top. There's no other leaves. What do I do with them?
I would chop them up and throw them in my compost pile, Mary.
That's what I thought.
You know, I think of poinsettias like a flower arrangement that I might buy. They're supposed to be a temporary decoration. When I buy a poinsettia, I'm not making a commitment to adding it to my houseplant collection forever or planting it out in my landscape where it may or may not look good. So generally speaking, think of your poinsettias as a temporary decoration and throw them away. One thing to keep in mind is if you do keep a poinsettia and you try to grow it in a pot, you will never again achieve anything close to how it appeared when you purchased it. It's just beyond our ability to grow those gorgeous poinsettias that you see available at nurseries and at florists. Now, you can plant a poinsettia in the ground. And Mary, if you have a nice sunny location that can accommodate a shrub that's going to get to be about 5 feet tall and 5 feet wide, that doesn't get artificial light at night, no floodlights, porch lights, or any kind of lights around it, you could plant it in the yard, cut it back about halfway, plant it in the yard, and it will make a nice bush, and they will bloom for Christmas time, barring freezes. They'll bloom for Christmas time, and poinsettias growing in the ground do make a nice bush with nice-sized flower. So if you want to try to grow it in a container, Don't ever expect it to do anything spectacular again. Plant it in the ground and it might, but only do that, Mary, if you walk around your landscape and say, you know, I could use a poinsettia right here. I think it would look beautiful here. Don't just plant one in the landscape because you've got it. Me, I throw every one of mine away. Every one of them. And I don't feel a bit guilty.
Okay. Well, thank you.
All righty. Thanks, Mary. Appreciate the call. Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be back with more of The Garden Show right after this. Good morning. It's a lovely, lovely day. Beautiful weekend, y'all. If you don't get out and get some gardening done this weekend, ooh, you're missing some of the best weather for it. So catch up on some of them chores. You'll be glad you did. You know that bed that needs to be weeded back behind there where you don't look very often, but you really need to take care of it. Well, good day for it. Let's head to the phones, y'all. We got Mary calling from Baton Rouge up next. Mary, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Dan. I'm trying to fertilize my Satsuma tree, and the directions said to measure the trunk and then put a spike to each one, but the bag with the spikes said that if it's 4 inches, go to 4 spikes, 5 spikes, and then it stops. So I didn't want to over-fertilize. So if it's 12 inches thick, so I should put 12 spikes, or do I just stop at 5?
That's a good question. Not seeing the directions, if it says to continue to add 1 spike per year indefinitely, that should But if it stops at 5, if it doesn't tell you to put out any more than 5, then that's the limit of what you can put out.
It doesn't say. It just says the directions just say, it says 4 inches, it starts at 2 inches, 2 3 inches, 3 spikes, 4 inches, 4 5 inches, 5 spikes, and then it stops. And so I don't know if you continue, if it just continues and they ran out of room or
yeah,
what.
Really?
Well,
so I Mary, I can tell you when we do for Ag Center recommendations, we may recommend a pound. Back in the old days, we might recommend a pound of 888 per year age of the tree up to about 8 years of age, and then it leveled off. So again, in my experiences, when we have fertilizer amounts based on a size or age, at some point we do tend to level them off. It's not like they continue on and on and on, and it is far better to under-fertilize than over-fertilize. So one other option would be to contact the manufacturer to try to clarify that for you and say, you know, how many should I put on a tree that has a 12-inch diameter trunk? And these days, they're usually websites or phone numbers on these product labels that allow you to contact the manufacturer, because I'm not sure under the circumstances what they intended you to do, whether they wanted you to continue to do one spike per inch indefinitely or there was a cutoff. And so, Mary, I hate to not be able to tell you for sure, but either stop at 5 is all I can tell you, or contact the manufacturer and double check and see.
Okay, thank you so much, Dan. I'll give them a call. Appreciate
it. Mary, thank you for the call.
Yes, sir.
Bye-bye now. Alrighty, folks, we got garden talk going on. We got beautiful weather outside. And if you've got a gardening question, don't forget to call on in. Let's take Mike calling in from the North Shore. Hey, Mike, good morning.
Good morning, Dan. Listen, I have 2 questions, if I may. I don't know how to determine. My sister said it's a lemon tree. My niece said it's a Satsuma. How can I determine which it is? And don't pick it and eat it.
Well, Mike, there's no similarity between lemons and Satsumas.
Oh, okay.
That's like you're asking me, you know, my sister says it's an apple and my aunt says it's a pear. How can I tell whether it's an apple or a pear?
Okay, because this one has thorns on the branches, and they bloom like lemon,
Mike,
but they grow like grapefruit.
You're not telling me anything that helps me know about what it is. It is the fruit that tells
okay.
you what kind of tree it is. Now, if it's a lemon, it will make a fruit that turns yellow a nice bright yellow color around about November, and when it turns yellow, it will be sour inside. If you have a satsuma, it will turn orange, a nice bright orange, no yellow to it. It's as orange can be. It's
well, thank
kind
you.
Of like a, it's kind of like a flattened pumpkin shape. It's a little flatter than it is round. The skin peels off easily from satsumas, and they tend to be seedless with a nice sweet flavor. They're not sour. So my
opinion, it just confuses me.
It just confuses me, though, when you say, I need to tell the difference between a lemon and a satsuma. They're just not the same thing.
Okay, well, you answered my question. It's a lemon tree.
All right.
Because it's bright yellow. Okay, the second question, if I may, it has plenty of fruit on it, but before they drop, even when they're on the tree, it has like mildew growing on the exterior. What could be causing that?
Well, there's citrus rust mites that will cause the outside of the fruit to get a darkish, sometimes a brownish color. It discolors the rind, but it doesn't hurt the quality of the fruit. The fruit's still good to eat. So it's really a cosmetic problem. The other issue could be sooty mold. Sucking insects like scale and things can make sooty mold. Again, the sooty mold is just on the outside of the fruit. It's just an aesthetic quality thing. It doesn't affect the taste of the fruit. So neither of those is really that bad. An oil spray, like a Volk oil or year-round spray oil or all-season spray oil, those will do a good job of controlling spider mite, rust mite during the summer, and can also control sucking insects with that sooty mold.
Well, you were a great help, and thank you very much, because now I definitely know it's a lemon tree, and now it's safe to eat. But just thanks a bunch, okay?
Well, Mike, all the citrus are safe to eat. One last thing, is the fruit round or lemon-shaped?
Round.
Then what you may have, Mike, is the rootstock has sprouted. It's neither a lemon nor a satsuma. It's the rootstock growing, and that may be a trifoliate orange or a swingle orange. They produce bitter, sour, seedy, round fruit. They're never meant to be intended to be allowed to grow. They're only meant to be the rootstock. So it sounds like one of your trees, the rootstock sprouted and has grown up and maybe taken over. And so it's not a lemon. If it was a lemon, it would be lemon-shaped. It's probably one of the trifoliate oranges. If you like the fruit, you can eat it. Most people consider it too bitter and seedy to fool with. But if you like to eat it, it's safe to eat.
Okay, well, the neighbors would get them like last year and stuff, and they said the same thing, that it is very bitter, like you said, and very seedy. So you was right on.
That's the rootstock, Mike.
Look, thanks a bunch again. You hear?
Oh, you're welcome, Mike. I really appreciate the call.
Have a great day. Bye-bye.
You too now. All righty, I've got Kevin calling in from Marrero. Kevin, good morning. I'm getting down to a couple of minutes here. What you got?
Yep, real quick. Thanks for taking my call. Around this time last year, my backyard, I thought it was having some subsidence. The ground was always really wet. So I added a little bit of fill dirt, some river sand to it to kind of raise it up a little bit, and then I bought some St. Augustine sod and covered it. Well, here we are a year later. I don't have any more grass, but what I do have is the little mounds in my yard. So, you know, working through it and trying to understand what's going on here is that I realize I have an infestation of mole crickets.
Okay, Kevin, just to jump in here real quick, because I know you're talking fast, and I appreciate it, because I'm getting down to the wire here. Kevin, there's a good chance you do not have mole crickets. Would it be possible for you to hold on through the three-minute news break that's coming up and I can get back to you? Because I can tell you some good things about mole cricket control.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you.
Ah, super, Kevin. Hold on. You'll be first up when we come back. Folks, we got to take a quick break here. We got the CBS news break coming up, and then Don Ames is in the newsroom to update you on the WWL First News. But after we update y'all on the news at the top of the hour, we'll be right back. Got Kevin lined up, and you can call with your garden questions at 504-260-1870, and I'll see y'all then. Good morning. Thanks for joining me on The Garden Show. feel free to call in with your gardening question. When we went to the news break, talking to Kevin about mole crickets, and a lot of information on the internet about mole crickets, a lot of stuff floating around, and mole crickets are oftentimes diagnosed, and many times there are other factors going on. Now, Kevin, what you're seeing right now is you laid your sod last year, and it's basically vanished. You're going to have to determine why that happened, and that's what you're trying to do right now. And you see these little mounds of soil in the bare areas. You see these little piles of soil. They look like little tiny mounds of little dirt BBs piled up in little piles here and there all over the area. And that's a common a symptom that is misdiagnosed as mole cricket activity. Now, mole cricket activity, what you would see in those bare areas, are long-running trails, as if an animal had burrowed just below the soil surface for about 3 or 4 feet, kind of zigzagging back and forth, like a mole would create a mound running through your lawn. Well, that's what mole crickets create, is they burrow under the ground. They don't create discrete mounds like what you're seeing. Who does do that are earthworms. And so what you're seeing are earthworm activity. With the rain we've been having, earthworms will come up from the soil to the soil surface, and they'll deposit their castings or droppings on the soil surface. Now, those are rich in nutrients. People buy worm castings to use as fertilizer. And worms aerate the soil, helping the lawns be healthy. So the activity that you're seeing, the earthworm activity you're seeing in the form of those mounds, is not mole cricket. It's beneficial earthworm activity. In addition, mole crickets don't live where there is no grass, because there's nothing for them to eat there. So the mole crickets would have long ago abandoned the bare areas, and they would really only be active where there is good thick lawn still available, and they wouldn't be that active through the bare areas. The earthworms, on the other hand, would be coming up anywhere they want to. So your job is this. Your job is to think back over last summer to how the lawn behaved. How long did it look good? When did it start to look bad? What were the symptoms? What area of the lawn started to look bad first? What were the symptoms in that area? How fast did it spread? Are there environmental conditions that may be playing a role? Shade is a major limiting factor to having lawns in some areas. So do you have any large trees, or do your neighbors have any large trees that might be creating shade issues that would prevent the lawn from growing? Or is drainage? You talked about drainage being an issue. You did some filling. Is drainage still something that you may need to look at? So, Kevin, you do need to continue to do some detective work. You're going to have to lay more sod, but before you do that, it would be a great idea to have a handle on what's going on. If it's shade, for instance, you can't change that. So you may have to rethink how you want to plant that area. If you can't have a lawn there, what would you want to have instead? If the conditions are good, if it's sunny, the drainage has been improved, and you want to give it another try, well, go ahead and lay a new crop of sod, but you watch it like a hawk. And the minute things begin to go south, you contact your local LSU Ag Center Extension office, and you get some help promptly diagnosing what's going on to try to head it off so that you don't lose your lawn again.
Well, that's great. Well, thank you for all the information. I think you nailed it there with the earthworms as well. So in addition to that, you know, every time it rains, I do see an abundance amount of earthworms that actually make it to the driveway. So that does, you know, line up there.
Yeah.
But and in addition, what you said, where the mole crickets are possibly around the grassy areas, I did find another spot near a tree that was starting to lose some, you know, where I had an actually nice little lawn going, but it started turning brown and low, and it's always kind of squishy. I took a gallon of water, mixed it with Dawn soap, and I poured it on that spot, and I did have a couple mole crickets pop up out of that location, but they're not coming from the location that is bare. So the dirt mounds that I am seeing are probably the earthworms on the bare spots,
but you know, the mole crickets have kind of mole crickets. Well, here's the deal. The controlling them now is hard. The mole crickets around now are adults. They're full grown and they're tough. So insecticide applications or baits applied now are of more limited benefit in controlling them because the adults are just more resistant. But you can apply insecticides to your lawn areas. You don't want mole cricket populations hiding in those areas for when you lay your new lawn. You want those cleaned out. So you can use bifenthrin is a commonly used. Tallstar is a brand name that you'll see. But any bifenthrin product will do a good job of controlling mole crickets. You can apply that now. You should get maybe some benefit. They're most vulnerable in June and July. That's when the mole crickets have laid their eggs and the eggs begin to hatch out. When the eggs hatch out, the old generation dies off, and the young nymphs, which are more vulnerable to insecticides, are all that's left. And so make some spray applications in June and July. That's their most vulnerable stage, and you'll find you'll get good control then.
Excellent. Well, Mr. Gill, thanks for taking my call today, and I appreciate all the information. I really appreciate it.
Well, appreciate you holding on, Kevin, and thanks. All righty, folks, we're taking a quick break. Hold on, because we're going to be right back. Good morning. We're talking gardening, and if you've got a gardening question, feel free to call on in. I want to remind you once again that going on today is a wonderful lecture that you're not going to want to miss. Patrick O'Connor, one of our leading specialists on Louisiana irises, is going to be lecturing today at the Botanical Garden City Park. A rare opportunity to get to hear Patrick lecture should not be missed. If you love Louisiana irises and would like to learn more about them, Patrick is going to present a really wonderful program. It's from 10:30 this morning. Until 11:30 this morning. It's at the New Orleans Botanical Garden. It'll be taking place in the Garden Study Center. And Patrick's going to cover, he's been hybridizing irises since the 70s and is, again, highly respected. He's going to be covering the natural history of the native Louisiana species that live here in Louisiana that have been used to hybridize these beautiful irises that we have. He's going to be looking at preservation efforts for those wild irises and how they were transformed from those wildflowers into the beautiful Louisiana irises we grow in our gardens today, along with cultural tips and all kinds of great information. The cost is $12 to attend the lecture, and again, it's taking place in the Garden Study Center of the New Orleans Botanical Garden in City Park from 10:30 until 11:30. Go on by there. Again, a great opportunity. He's going to have some gorgeous pictures. Make your mouth water how beautiful the irises are. Go by there and get to hear Patrick speak. You'll be glad you did. Alrighty, let's hit the phones. We've got Dan calling in from Metairie. Up next, Dan, good morning.
Good morning, Dan. I have two questions about kumquats. I still have fruit on my tree from last year, and it's terrible. I mean, it's all squishy, and all. Should I just get rid of that now? Can I pick them off and throw them away?
Absolutely. Okay. Pick them off and, you know, throw them in your compost pile. That's a good thing to do. In fact, everybody listening, you really need to be removing or have removed all of your old citrus, ripe citrus at this point. The only exception is if you're growing Valencia oranges. They don't ripen until April or May. But all other citrus, you need to be taking that ripe fruit off. What else you got, Dan?
This is the bad one. My kumquat, the same kumquat tree, is still looking terrible from the freeze. The leaves, I have no new leaves on it at all. It's still dropping leaves, but not very many, just a few at a time. And they're rather yellow. I fertilized it in early February. Should I be giving up on it, or do I still have a chance?
You know, Dan, that's going to be your decision. You know, it's kind of like when you bring your pet that you love to the vet, and the end is near, and you go, should I end it now or should I end it later? And the vet is going to tell you, you know, that's going to be your decision. And although not quite so dramatic, perhaps, that's the answer I have to give you. When you decide the tree just can't make it, you've given it plenty of time and it's going downhill, then you'll know when it's time to remove it. When you don't have any hope left for it, that's the time it's going to be.
But do you think it should have put out new leaves by now?
It certainly could have.
Okay.
It certainly could have, but in its current condition, depending on how much damage it sustained, maybe it can't. So it certainly could have put out better growth, and it could be recovering a lot better. So your tree is certainly in dire straits. But when you decide to remove it, it's going to be up to you.
Oh, I'll take it down when it's all leafless.
Well, there you go. Now you've set the criteria, and you can relax.
Thank you, Dan. As usual, you've been a big help. Bye-bye.
Sure thing, Dan. Take care. All righty, we've got Sydney calling in from Baton Rouge up next. Sydney, good morning.
Good morning, Dan. My question is, I have two oak trees in my front yard. They're both 25 years old. One of them drops acorns, and these little oak trees grow, and it's very difficult to get rid of them. And I was wondering if there was something I could do to mitigate the labor involved in clearing up that area.
Not really, Sydney. I mean, there's no way to make your oak not make acorns.
Okay.
And it varies from year to year. Oaks tend to produce cyclically. So some years will be especially heavy, some years not. And the trees are not necessarily on the same cycle. So one year, one tree may be heavier, the other year, another tree may be heavier. But there's really no good way to stop the acorns from being produced. Perhaps investing in a yard vacuum that will efficiently suck up the acorns would be the best way to collect them and dispose of them to minimize the seedlings that come up, because they can be a real big nuisance. I agree with you there.
Yes. Okay. Well, that's a good idea. I'll do that.
All right, Sydney. Take care.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. Taking a break, but don't go away. We'll be back with more of the... Good morning. Thanks for tuning in. Let's head to the phones. Got Gina calling in from Orange Beach, Alabama. Gina, good morning.
Good morning, Dan. My question is, I just put all my compost in my garden, and I've formed my rows, and I'm ready to plant. And I wanted to know, I want to use a soaker or drip. I want to know what's the best, why are they different, what's different about them, and, you know, what would be the best way to go. You know, I'm planting tomatoes and stuff like that. What's your best?
Well, the soaker hose is the easiest to deal with. You just unroll it down the row. Drip mm-hmm. irrigation has emitters and tubes and is a bit more difficult to set up and maintain. Emitters clog and all kind of stuff. So it's not bad, but if it was me, I would go the simple route and just use a soaker hose. The tremendous benefit, Gina, is that you don't wet the foliage of the vegetables. Keeping vegetable foliage dry reduces diseases. We should never wet the foliage of our tomatoes when we water them. We're just making diseases worse. So using a soaker hose, superb idea, Gina. Go for it.
That's what I heard. So that's what I wanted to do this year. But I just didn't know which one to go buy. So the best thing to buy would be the soaker, roll it out, and just put it on top of the rows and let it go.
It's as simple as that.
And Dan, how often, I'm going to get a timer. How often should I water? Like every day? How long?
Well, now, you know that depends on the rain, Gina. So
right.
You're going to have to evaluate the weather conditions. You're going to have to go right. out and test the soil, you know, dig with a trowel, see how wet or dry it is. So don't just try to do this by, you know, mental telepathy with your tomatoes. Go out there and dig in your garden. Take a look at the soil. When it's been several days without rain, it's getting dry. You know you need to water. Now, as far as how long to leave it on, Gina, I'd recommend you turn it on for about 20 or 30 minutes. Turn it off, okay. And then go, wait for about 15 minutes, and then go out there and dig around the line. See how far it penetrated and how far out it spread. You may need to leave it on a little longer or not quite so long, but calibrate it by leaving it on for about 20 or 30 minutes, letting it go for about 15 minutes, and then checking to see. And you can adjust how long to leave it on when you do need to water by doing that. This is not rocket science. It's just you using your hands, digging in the dirt, your eyes, to make sure that you are applying enough water to those tomatoes.
Great. Dan, you always have excellent advice. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Appreciate you calling in from Alabama, Gina. Take care now.
Thank you.
All righty. We have Janelle from Columbia, Mississippi. And Janelle, I'm down to about a minute or so, but I wanted to see, maybe it's a quick question. What you got?
It is a quick question. The last 2 years we've planted tomatoes, and we suspect that we have tomato wilt because they'll be growing perfectly, and then the next day they're all wilted and dying. So we wanted to know what we could do to the soil to prevent that from happening.
Nothing. Janelle, there is no treatment for the soil for tomato wilt, you've got to move to another area and plant your tomatoes in another area, or you may have to abandon the soil and begin to plant in 5-gallon containers of potting soil. Unfortunately, this is one of the most limiting factors. I hate to hear you've had such problems with it, but Janelle, nothing you can do to the soil. Sorry about that.
Well, that's what we suspected, but now we know. So thank you for your help.
Sure thing. All righty, folks. Thanks to everybody that called in. You know you make the show, and I appreciate you all for tuning in as well. We'll be having more Garden Show next Saturday morning. Y'all come back and visit with us then. Until then, good gardening.